Dateline, Brussels, Belgium, the Eurozone meeting on Greece. Yeah, that was a can. Being kicked down the road. There's a deal. Kind of. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 20th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The very broad outlines of the deal that the 19-member Eurozone, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank made with Greece late today goes a little bit like this. Athens gets a four-month extension of its current bailout. It had wanted 6 months, by the way. It had been scheduled to expire at the end of this month. It gets about $10 billion in cash to tide them over, and in return, the newly elected Greek government is going to have to provide by Monday, as in 72 hours or so from now, a detailed list of exactly what reforms it is going to make sure that it can pay its bills. So, Greece, to absolutely nobody's surprise, I am sure, is where we are going to start today, our weekly wrap. Here to do that with us are Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hello, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So, Catherine, let's start with you. No surprise that they came to some sort of at least détente, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think nobody wanted Greece to exit from the Eurozone at this point. That seems to be bad for markets, bad for Greece, probably bad for the Eurozone. So, you know, everybody kind of had to bite the bullet and say, OK, we'll come to some compromise.
Right.
So that you know, Lehman times 1,000 doesn't happen.
However, Sudeep, we are doing this again in 4 months. We could have you guys back on probably and just roll the same pieces of tape.
Yes, and the circumstances probably will not have changed all that much. There are really only two ways this entire mess is going to end. One is that Greece leaves the Eurozone, and the other is that Greece takes at least some additional action that is deeply, deeply unpopular. And
right.
You have to remember,
at home,
they've already, exactly, and they've already gone through a Great Depression of their own, and they have to do more of that to be able to stay in and keep getting money from their bailout partner. So that's a lot to ask of them, and it's a lot to be spending time on in the Eurozone. Greece is 2% of the Eurozone. There are 18 other countries that are having problems right now, and a lot more energy needs to be going to fixing the other 98% of the Eurozone instead of just spending time on figuring out how to kick the can on Greece.
All right, so what do you think, by the way? Brilliant little piece of tape there, huh? Kicking the can? Come on. Somebody?
Yes, it was great.
All right,
yes,
thank you.
I liked it.
Thank you. Get a little chuckle. All right. Speaking of tape, I want to play one more piece of tape for you. It is Jeroen Dijsselbloem. He is the Dutch finance minister. He's also the president of the Eurogroup, the Eurozone group of countries. Speaking tonight in Brussels about the intensive negotiations they have had. Here you go.
It was intense because it was about building trust between us.
Seems to me, Catherine, trust is pretty much shot because you've got Yanis Varoufakis coming in and saying all these things that he wants and that the Greeks are not going to do. You've got Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, saying, no, you're not going to do this. How do they reconstruct this in a way that in 4 months something actually gets fixed?
If I knew the answer to that question, I would
rich. So here's a better question. Can they? Can they reestablish that trust?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they're ideologically are so far apart at this point that the Greeks are basically saying anything you want us to do is going to make us less likely to be able to pay our bills,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they're arguing that the austerity measures are basically the reason why they can't make good on the loan that's
mm-hmm.
been made to them. And obviously, the rest of the Eurozone, led by Germany, feels the exact opposite, that no, you need to do more belt tightening, and that's the only way you'll be able
right.
to pay us back.
Right.
So I don't know. There's such a stark divide that it's hard to kind of wrap my head around how they might be able to come together and see eye to eye.
All right, fair enough. So, Sudeep, last question goes to you, and it's a sort of an economic version of would you rather. The Fed minutes came out this week talking about when the rates may or may not go up. Which will be worse for the American economy? Let me rephrase that. Which will have a greater impact on the American economy? If the Eurozone has a crisis involving Greece or when the Fed raises rates?
At least with the Fed raising rates, we know what a little bit of what that looks like when the process starts, because we've been going for so long through all the motions of trying to get to that place. With the Eurozone, we know that it will probably be less bad than it would have been 2 or 3 years ago, but we still know that if the Eurozone falls apart, if Greece breaks off, if other countries start to go through the same dynamics, we don't know how that's going to end, and that's where it's a lot. It's still a pretty scary scenario, and that's why I would rather be in the position of worrying about what the Fed is going to do.
Catherine, same question to you quickly.
I would agree with that assessment. Mm-hmm. We know what the Fed raising rates looks like. A lot of forecasters have kind of built it into their models already. There are so many unknowns for what could go wrong with Greece.
Okay. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He, though, is in Washington. She is in New York. Go figure that one out. Have yourselves a good weekend, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Kai.
Word that that Greek deal came just about as the closing bell was ringing on Wall Street, and thus the happy music will be upon us. We'll have the details when we always have the details. We're going to do a story now about oil. And we're going to start it with a number, a closely watched number, but not probably the number you are thinking we are going to start with, the price of oil today. No, we are going to start with something called the rig count. Just like it sounds, the number of rigs out there drilling away. It's falling, as you might imagine it would be with oil relatively cheap right now. But what exactly can that number tell us? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has the answer.
The rig count has been around more than 70 years, and it's still considered an industry vital sign. As of today, 1,019 rigs are operating. That's 37% less than last year, and everyone is talking about it. Jake Dollarhide runs Longbow Asset Management in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Whenever the local TV stations are opening their newscast with what is the price of gasoline, that's when everyone starts following the rig count.
The rig count, put out by oil services firm Baker Hughes, is the best real-time data from the oil patch. But be careful, TV watchers. Before you assume a plunge in rigs means a similar plunge in oil supply, pay attention to analyst Eric Kuhl of Wood Mackenzie.
We've seen a strong disconnect in the correlation between production versus the number of rigs active.
Disconnect. What he means is the rigs put on the bench tend to be, how do I put this, the loser rigs.
We started to see many of the lower performance rigs being let off first.
He says the disconnect began when the U.S. started getting lots of oil from shale rock in places like North Dakota. Also, technology and experience make modern rigs more and more productive. Still, the rig count has cratered so steeply, most think production has to fall some. Princeton Energy Advisors Stephen Kopitz.
Obviously, if we're losing, you know, half of the rigs out there, then clearly that's going to impact production over a period of time.
It's just a question of how much. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The automotive rumor du jour, or of the week, actually, is that Apple is working on a car, an electric car, that, again, rumor has it, is going to be ready for your driveway in 5 years. Apple, of course, has confirmed nothing of the sort, but we're going to take the bait anyway and try to figure out what it's going to take for Apple to hit the road. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
So I was feeling the urge to head out to my local Apple store to be the first in line for the iCar. Is 5 years ahead too soon? But I thought I'd check in with the experts first. So I called up J.P. Gounder of Forrester Research.
I would say you're being very, very premature.
Gounder says establishing a car business from scratch is a Herculean task.
The car industry is a particularly difficult one to break into.
First, says Dennis Virag, president of the Automotive Consulting Group, you need money.
To develop a vehicle from a ground up could be anywhere from $1 to perhaps $5 billion at the top end.
$5 billion? No problem. Apple's sitting on $178 billion in cash. But then Apple needs to get real. Virag says add up the time to develop a supply chain and build a factory, and it could take 10 years.
The non-auto manufacturers really underestimate what it takes to get the product to market and to become profitable.
Yeah, take Tesla. It's been on the road since 2008, but it's had trouble opening dealerships. And the company says it won't be profitable until 2020. So why would Apple even bother? Because it has to, says Tilo Kozlovsky of Gartner Research.
The car is becoming a very fundamental piece of the puzzle that you need to own if you indeed want to create experiences for your customers wherever they are.
And Apple is not alone, whatever its intentions. Google has already developed a self-driving car. Uber is funding research into a world without drivers at all. And not to be left out, several major car makers have opened up research facilities in Silicon Valley. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
We've been doing the unsung heroes of the Oscars this week, the storyboard artists and the casting directors and the assistant directors. Today, a very sung hero of the Academy Awards, the 8.5-pound gold-plated naked statuette that the whole shebang is all about anyway. The Oscar is one of the most recognized trophies in the world. It's got more gold on it than any other trophy out there, by the way, and it has been made for the past 30 years by R.S. Owens & Company, where they make a whole lot of other big-name awards as well. Joseph Petrie is the design director there. Mr. Petrie, good to have you with us.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How does one get in the business of making all these trophies and statuettes?
It's a very interesting business, to say the least. I started myself about 25 years ago. And I always wanted things I couldn't afford, so I learned how to make them. And recognition is certainly one of those.
It absolutely is. Oscars, Emmys, what else do you guys make?
We've made a lot of awards for NASCAR. We do the Cotton Bowl. We do a lot of different bowl games, actually. We do Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Let's get to the big one, then, the actual Academy Award. It is technically, I heard, the Academy Award of Merit. Is that right?
Yeah, whenever it was originally designed, I believe he was originally drawn on a napkin, and one of the librarians at the Academy said, you know, that looks like my Uncle Oscar.
Yeah.
And I guess it kind of took.
Do you guys just have a standing order with the Academy? I mean, every, you know, February you start cranking out 50 of these things and then you're done?
Actually, we start communicating with the Academy about third or fourth quarter of the year, you know, before we're going to produce.
Yeah.
We start verifying quantities and things of that nature. Right now, the Academy is building a brand new facility, so we're working with them on inventory for that and things for display. So the numbers do vary somewhat, but on average, it's between 50 and 60.
How much repair work do you guys do on these things, right? Because if they get dented or dinged, you guys basically rebuild them, don't you?
Absolutely. We get shipments every now and then from the Academy. They'll correspond with us and let us know that they're coming. And then we will assess what actually needs to be done as far as the repair work is concerned. If it's just polishing them up and plating them up again and getting them, you know, dusted off. But we have had them come in various stages of being melted or having you know, dents in the back of their head where somebody used them as a hammer. some odd things, to say the least.
Is this thing made on an assembly line, or are they done by hand? How does it work?
Everything about Oscar is made entirely by hand. On every Oscar, there's a security number, a serial number on the back that coincides with one that's underneath the base so that if, God forbid, anything ever happens, they can be traced. And we don't know who is going to get that particular statue. Those serial numbers are tracked, you know, at the Academy. And whenever they go to the actual event, they grab them at random. They don't grab them in numerical sequence.
Yeah?
Yeah. And it doesn't become somebody's until he goes out on that stage. And when he goes out on that stage, and obviously the applause are done, now he belongs to that person. And, you know, we produce a plate for everybody who is nominated. We don't know who's going to win. And then they have those out at the event, and they have them separated by category. And so they know which category is going to come up. And then whenever the winner's announced, then they'll pull that particular plate and off they go.
Well, Mr. Petrie, thanks very much. That's Joseph Petrie. He's the design director at R.S. Owens, talking about the Academy Awards. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
To speak metaphorically, today's internet is the size of a golf ball. Tomorrow will be the size of the sun.
That's a whole lot of digital space out there. What do you suppose could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 0.8% today, 154 points, 18,140 the number. The NASDAQ hiked 0.6%, 31 points, 49.55. The S&P 500 stepped up 0.6%, 12 points, finished at 21.10. For the week, the Dow up 0.7%, the NASDAQ up 1.3%, the S&P 500 finished up 0.6%. Apple revved up 0.8% today on news that the company might be planning to build an electric car, possibly sort of, kind of, don't know, Tesla Motors. Charged up 2.5% today. Farm equipment maker Deere & Company lifted 0.75%, even though the company said a decline in sales led to a sharp drop in quarterly profits. We talked about that closely watched rig count earlier. Shares in oil services company Baker Hughes, which releases that count, fell more than 1% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday.
What did the housing market look like at the top of the year? The National Association of Realtors is scheduled to report on sales of existing homes for January. Dish will announce quarterly earnings. And 20 years ago, the Dow Jones hit a milestone. It was above 4,000 at the closing bell for the first time. Cue the happy numbers music. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We all go out to eat every now and then, right? But the fact is, almost no matter where you go, if you were to take a peek into the kitchen, chances are real good there'd be cans back there from Sysco Foods. Seafood, chicken, pork, baked goods, you name it. Sysco is the biggest food distributor in the country. As it happens, they've got a $3.5 billion bid in to buy a competitor, U.S. Foods, which the Federal Trade Commission filed suit this week to block. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has our story on Sysco's surprising reach.
Before we think about the merger, let's look at what Sysco does. It's a food distribution company that provides everything an average restaurant might need. Paper products, meat, vegetables. Ben Lawrence is a professor at Cornell's Hotel School. He says many restaurants opt for Sysco because it's just less of a hassle.
It's a decision that you have to make, whether or not you want to take that time to deal with two or three or four distributors, or you want to deal with one distributor that can actually provide you with everything you need.
So a lot of restaurants don't want to think about whether their canned tomatoes will arrive on time every time. But then again, if you're a fancy restaurant and you want vine-ripened heirloom tomatoes, you might find yourself looking for a gourmet distributor.
These chefs can be very snobby, and to them it's almost, you know, why would I do business with Sysco when my job is to get something very different? And Sysco's, you know, considered sort of the Chevrolet of the industry.
Andrew Wolf is a senior analyst with BB&T Capital Markets. A merged Sysco and U.S. Foods would dominate the so-called broadline food service distribution industry. That's the market for basics. But the FTC says this new company would control three-quarters of this broadline market. Sysco argues it would control one-quarter of the overall market. Debbie Feinstein, director of the Bureau of Competition at the FTC, says there's a reason you already see the two companies' trucks everywhere.
They deliver to hotels, to local restaurants, to hospitals, to college campuses.
So whether Sysco and U.S. Foods would dominate the, quote, broadline food distribution market isn't really up for debate. The question is, what's a market and who gets to decide? As for this one, the courts will get the final say. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Among the subjects being debated today on Twitter are newly circulated pictures of Beyoncé, which are said not to have been photoshopped. They show a few blemishes, apparently. Interesting as that is, it would only be the latest in a never-ending series of leaked celebrity photos, but for this, the 25th birthday of Photoshop itself. Version 1.0 launched this week back in 1990, and over the past 25 years, it has pretty much reshaped the way we see the world and ourselves, as Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
Back in the 1980s, when Thomas Knoll created the software that became Photoshop, he didn't envision that it would become, among other things, a verb. The Oxford English Dictionary added it in 2006 to the official chagrin of Adobe, where Knoll still works.
Adobe Legal always sort of fights that, but not too hard.
Bad for the trademark, but not so bad for the brand. However, in addition to manipulating photos generally, photoshopping has become shorthand for how the beauty industries promote unrealistic images of women's faces and bodies, and that Knoll takes issue with.
That manipulation is nothing new in the market, but what Photoshop did was make it easier to do.
And with the help of digital networks, maybe easier to see through. Jesse Roston is a commercial photographer who once made a parody video about how Photoshop promotes unrealistic images of women.
There's only one way to look like a real cover girl. Photoshop by Adobe.
Maybe she's born with it.
No, I'm pretty sure it's Photoshop.
But he thinks maybe Photoshop's ubiquity increases our awareness that celebrities don't really look like that either.
Back when people were airbrushing negatives, you wouldn't have ever seen the original negative.
Photoshop has also given us whole industries that no one could have foreseen, like Ben Hu's empire. He's CEO of Cheeseburger, a collection of blogs devoted to stuff like funny cat pictures. But as photoshopping has become something everybody does, Photoshop software has become less central to it.
The vast majority of photoshopping, quote-unquote, people do today is probably Instagram.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Twenty years ago, Mark Goodman was a cop, a sergeant in the Los Angeles Police Department. And one day, his boss asked him whether he knew how to use spell check on WordPerfect. Like I said, it was 20 years ago. Weren't perfect. Anyway, he did. Shift F2, by the way. And that was enough to land him his first computer crimes case. 20 years on, Mark has worked on cybercrime with the FBI, Interpol, and the Secret Service, and he has written some of what he has learned in a book called Future Crimes. Mark, thanks for coming into the studios.
Pleasure's mine.
There is a quote from this book that I think puts this all into perspective. Never before in the history of humanity has it been possible for any one person to steal $110 million of anything, let alone concurrently rob more than 100 million people. So basically, we're done, right? I mean, there's no hope.
Well, there's hope for sure. But what we're seeing is a fundamental shift, a paradigm shift in crime. Crime used to be a one-on-one affair. Go out and buy a knife or a gun if you were a criminal, rob one person at a time. Now, through technology, crime scales.
And we now, humanity, you say, have rushed headlong without a lot of self-reflection into this world where we click and Google and Facebook and live and you say basically die by the screen.
Well, the fact is that we've wired the world, which is awesome, but we failed to secure it. And that's a threat that's going to increase as we move forward. Every physical object is going online due to something called the Internet of Things.
Right.
Today, we use Internet Protocol version 4. We can support about 4.5 billion simultaneous devices on the net talking at one time. But we've run out of space. The same way New York City had to split into different area codes because they ran out of phone numbers.
Right.
The same has happened on the Internet. So we're launching Internet Protocol version 6. That will support not 4.5 billion, but 78 octillion simultaneous connections. And I had to look this up myself.
Yeah, please.
An octillion is 78 octillion is 78 billion. Billion, billion. To speak metaphorically, today's internet is the size of a golf ball. Tomorrow will be the size of the sun.
One of the things that I guess I came to fully appreciate in this book was the degree to which cybercrime and cybercriminals have become corporatized. I mean, they have structures and reporting requirements and the whole deal.
The modern criminal enterprise doesn't look much like Tony Soprano's organization. They have CEOs, CFOs, they have marketing departments, they do search engine optimization. They even have quality assurance. So before a piece of crimeware or criminal software leaves the crime factory, it's actually tested against 300 different types of antivirus software to make sure that the virus will survive and go undetected.
Here's the thing, though. We were promised a techno-utopia, right? I mean, forget paperless office, man. It goes way beyond that. We were promised paradise.
Yes.
And now it's turning out to be not paradise.
There is an ominous flip side of all of the technology that we use. I do believe in the techno-utopia. I believe very much that technology can be a driving force for good, but it's not going to happen automatically. Most people are sitting back and just using the technological tools that have been created for them by others. But they don't stop to think, what's really happening when I push a button on this screen or click on a link?
Is that because we don't want to know? I mean, I just want my stuff to be ready when I want it, you know?
I get the fact that we all just want it to work, and you shouldn't need a PhD in computer science to be able to use a telephone. But those people that are willing to put the time, energy, and effort into understanding how the technology works are becoming the new literate classes. Hmm. If we think back 500 years ago, it was the priests that could read. Yeah. They would interpret the Bible and tell people what God was saying. That literacy gave them power. The new form of literacy is coding. In a world where every physical object is becoming hardware or software, whether it be planes, elevators, cars, or laptops, if you can control that underlying code, then you can control the world.
What do we do? Right? Because there's a very serious temptation to stick your fingers in your ears and go, la, 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 because if I ignore it, it won't hurt me.
There are many things that we can do. You were talking about techno-utopia. We can have a much brighter technological future, but we'll have to go off the current path. So I think we need to get much more serious about it. I'm working with the XPRIZE Foundation to create an incentive prize for cybersecurity. I also think that we should be creating now a National Cybersecurity Reserve Corps. We have reserve Marines, reserve police officers, reserve Army. The day of that cyber threat, when our electrical grids are commandeered and that big event occurs, we're definitely not going to have enough people. The time to plan for a disaster is not during the disaster. Hmm. Only by acknowledging the risk can we move forward. So ultimately, by providing this information, people will leave empowered in terms of protecting themselves, their families, their children, and their businesses.
It's a book called Future Crimes by Mark Goodman. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kai.
There is more from that interview. Enough cybercrime facts to make you really, really paranoid, I gotta tell you. It's at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which I lift shamelessly from a line that my producer, Sitar Nieves, gave me right before I came into the studio. Billboard reported this week that Starbucks is going to stop selling compact discs, actual physical compact discs, in its store come March. There was a time, Billboard says, when Starbucks was doing $65 million a year in CD sales, but no more because, and here comes the line of the day, Starbucks is going to stop selling what nobody listens to music on anymore anyway. Ba-dum-ba. All right, that's it. The Dow up 0.8% today, 154 points on a Friday. The NASDAQ bumped up 0.6%, 31 points. The S&P 500 stepped itself up 0.6%. That is 12 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by the aforementioned Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.